Morning.
Cover up your orange, bold, and bright, sparkly. And it's going to warm up, which is good, right, Bob?
That's very good.
Because we're all clean Mother Earth today. But you want to make a little announcement?
Well, we've got a great day for it, but we're going to do our annual Salmon Day, and good if those who are participating could carpool. We could meet after our meeting and arrange all the tools and bags are provided. If you could go out for an hour even, or 2 hours, usually our coordinator's out there 3 hours, Sea Higgins. We're going to go out and we'll meditate on the dunes, just like in a Japanese movie, you know. We can have lunch together there, and then maybe about
5 minutes meditation or something. And where are they meeting? You'll tell them there, but like I have to go home first, so you'll be meeting in the...
Well, we drive over Salmon Creek, you just go out, you know, Bodega, all the way to Highway 1, and it's about 3 or 4 miles north of the Bodega Bay. And there's, you can't miss it. It's a big public beach. And north side there, north end.
So if you're coming south to north, there's a creek. It's not the parking lot on the south side. It's the parking lot that's up on the bluff on the north side.
That's true.
Right. Some of us may go over to the south side. I was just there last weekend. There's lots of cleanup.
Yeah, she tells you what to do. And the Salmon Creek is really raging. It's cold. Some years we've gone out and just wade across the creek and do the others. But anyway, she coordinates all that and tells you.
Thank you for coordinating it. And let's see, a little late, but our yearly calendar is up on the website. If you plug into that, what I remember of it, I should just print out the kind of more important ones. There'll be a one-day, half-day sitting. Right now, it'll be at my house. Next month, I don't know when, the 20th, Sunday. I mean, I'll give you a notice, Sangha won't be here, half-day sitting until about 1. And then the next event will be a two-day sitting, looks like also at our house, Glen Bostown. Chris will join the Lotus Sangha to a two-day sitting, non-residential. So we'll probably, you know, start around 8 o'clock or 8:30, go, we'll have a simple lunch there, sit until 5, and then people will go home. Posted about that, and there'll be a sign-up sheet for that. And I think the next, weekend in December is our upper retreat, and then we'll do the practice period. But that's all. Also in the fall, I'm going to start doing, some night during the week, I do a precepts class where we'll go through the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. I'll do that. Maybe I'll do a practice period. But I may just continue that one night a week. It can't be in a Wednesday night class in Santa. So I wanted to continue with one of our favorite topics. Probably I've got at least one more, because I seem to have a little irritation that comes up periodically. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to Dharma to work with that. Or Jim Baker used to say, we're all pretty nice until somebody insults us, you know, or wall, or we read something in the newspaper that doesn't align with our belief system. And so easy. It seems to be right there. And we have to kind of know ourselves. Are we the kind of person that, as the Lojan says, you're the primary witness. You're the one that knows where you need to practice. And maybe you're one of those people, hard time coming up with a no. No, don't do this. Or no, I can't do this. And it takes some kind of energy to get you to the no. So if you're one of those people, your practice is a little different from those of us that maybe it's a little easier to say no. We get irritated a little too quickly. So our practice tends to be a little bit different. Buddhism usually tends to come down, as we focused on last week, more on the side of the prime directive is Buddhism is do no harm. So when we're irritated and angry and that's expressed, it distances ourselves, doesn't connect us. And so the teachings are directed towards that state of mind that's angry, that separates us. Not that we don't try to change things, but so I'm going to review a little bit of what we said last week, and then we'll try to move on to more kind of what's the positive, is there a positive use for anger or irritation? And so I ask you to think about what I'm going to say and what some of the teachers say, and we'll break into some groups like we did last week and talk about this, how you apply these teachings. Are you more on one end of the spectrum needs to come up on your no, or are you on the other side that needs to really modulate and work with your? A lot of contemporary teachers take not stay around this. But again, last week, remember, we went back to the earlier teachings, the Dhammapada. And you know, for those of you that don't know, the Buddhist teachings are divided what they call into the Tripitaka, or the three baskets. And the three baskets of teaching are the Vinaya, which in our reference point is the 16 bodhisattva precepts, and the more traditional, like the Dalai Lama or traditional celibate tradition, there's like 350 rules and precepts. That's in the Vinaya. There's a whole body of literature on that. And we're most familiar with Sutta, or Sutra Tripitaka, which is the teachings from the Buddha or his main disciples, like Shariputra. And those are divided into five categories called the Nikayas. Bob's actually watching. Nikayas, and the Dhammapada comes from one branch of those five called the short teachings. So the Dhammapada, which I all encourage you to get, 26 chapters. It's wonderful just to wake up in the morning, open it up, and read that. It synthesizes the early teachings. Buddhism, which emphasizes more restraint. And from that, of course, comes the sense of passion, which is developed later in the Mahayana tradition. And then the third basket is called the Abhidharma, which is a synthesization about how to take the sutras and apply it in practical and psychological. First presentation of psychology, which is emphasized, that particular basket is emphasized more in the Theravada. So again, the one, a couple of lines in the Dhammapada. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupt mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. So very attentive, what's going on in your mind, and how much energy do you put into the thoughts? If you're putting a lot of energy, if thoughts come through, angry, irritation, and you just let them go, not a lot of karmic repercussion from that. But if a thought comes through and you sit there and you turn it and you verify it and you solidify it and you concretize it, you know, whether it's about something wrong with somebody else or something wrong with yourself, which we're so inclined to do, suffering results. The very seminal teacher of the Buddha. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows. Speak or act or think with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows, like a never-departing shadow. He abused me, he attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those carrying on like this, hatred does not end. It doesn't say that what that person says or does justify or accurate. It just says, it comes at you, you respond with aggression, defensiveness, hatred will not end. You will not attain peace. He abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those not carrying on like this, hatred ends. And then the seminal quotation, hatred never ends through hatred, by non-hatred alone. Does it calming the mind by cultivating a sense of understanding? This is the ancient truth. Many do not realize this. We here must die. Meaning part of your mind, that part of yourself that's so self-centered on your own sense of rightness, self-righteousness. For those who realize this, quarrels end. So that's one of the most important chapters. And then the last two paragraphs, again, I'll read. One who recites many teachings, but being negligent, doesn't act accordingly, like a cowherd counting others' cows, does not attain the benefits of the contemplative life. Scholarship alone isn't going to do it. Practice a sense of mindfulness of how your mind. One who recites but a few teachings, but lives according to the Dharma, abandoning passion, ill will, and delusion, aware and with mind well freed, not, this is a nice phrase, not clinging to this life or the next. You're in the world, but you're not grabbing hold of this world. Or also not attached to some other state, whether some idea of heaven or whatever. More focused on what's happening present, in the present. Not clinging to this life or the next attains the benefits of the contemplative life. Essence of our meditative act again and again to the immediate moment and how to. And then we talked about Shariputra and how he was giving us various metaphors about how to work with people with anger. The one way is to think of it as like a dirty rag or somebody who's been conditioned, soiled by their upbringing and condition. We have a lot of compassion for that when we realize that that rag can be cleansed and used. And so home washed it, the monk washed it and made it into a robe, you know, to wrap the Buddha's teaching in. Or you use it as like a pond with algae on it, or like a muddy puddle that you need to drink out of. You have to be very careful and very patient and not approach it with a sense of aggression, but a sense of a lot of patience and skill in terms of waiting for an opportunity to encourage peaceful conduct in the person. And then the last one is, what about somebody who just seems to be evil? Quality, speaks with anger, acts with anger. So as you treat that person, as you reject them, they're suffering. You know, we're a physician. You don't say, well, I'm sorry, I'm just taking you as a patient, not taking you as a patient. Treat them as a sick person because they're suffering. Physically suffering, they're suffering mentally, and they're causing other people to suffer. That engenders a sense of compassion. That's in one of the early Buddhapatika, one of the Nikayas, is that teaching from Shariputra. So, I wanted to go now to the teaching. There was an interesting article by Ken McLeod, who I appreciate a lot as a teacher. He's done several three-week retreats, cloistered environment. Either they don't leave at all, the food is delivered to them, or they only come out for the meals, they go back in again. This is for three. And then their teacher visits them there to eat practice. And he's done at least two of them. And so what he says in this article is that if there is a place, he says, there is a place for anger. He says, if anger is in the service of ego, then it is aggression. So say a lot about things. You say, well, what does that mean in the service? Say, well, you know, examples that come to me, but see what comes to you would be those examples when somebody insults you. You get angry. How easy it is for you to get angry. That would be an example of where he's saying you need to be very careful about anger. That turns to aggression. And that would make sense in a Buddhist context, because in a Buddhist, you're trying to grow this sense of a solid self. You know, the three marks of Buddhism. No permanent self, impermanence, insubstantiality of everything conditioned in the phenomenal world. It all is going to change. So because of the seminal teaching, these foundational teachings of Buddhism, of course, wouldn't want to reify or solidify the sense of self. That's, of course, where that comes from. The other one I thought is the sense of ideas. You have an idea of, well, this is right. And you get angry when people impeach that sense of what you think is right. You reach out and put yourself in other people's shoes, which I've been working a lot with, actually. Point to read some of the more conservative editorials in the newspaper. Try to get an idea of where other people's pain is coming from, where this current political situation comes from. Not that I'm going to support it. Not that I'm going to do what I need to try to move things to a more inclusive presentation. But at least I can understand where the pain is coming from, where this anger is coming from. So McLeod says that kind of aggression that solidifies around the ego, that's the one you have to be very careful. But he says the kind of anger that arises out of a sense of when you see other people are suffering. And he says that there is a kind of appropriateness to that because it can clarify a situation and it can energize you. And I felt that when I, for example, went to in Oakland. I can feel that in the terms of when I'm writing a check to the Southern Poverty Law Center or the ACLU. There's something about that that gets me to write that check or to go to that situation. And so he says that kind of energy is appropriate. And I think if you study most of the social movements, some of the great social movements have come out of that sense of injustice. You know, and it's just not a calm, peaceful kind of awareness. You know, Gandhi, even though, and Martin Luther King, even though very committed to nonviolence, there was a sense of, no, this is not right. And what McLeod is saying is that if you can get in touch with that, that can be appropriate and perhaps necessary. But it's also a slippery slope, because I know from the nature of people, myself, is if you have been wounded yourself and you experience injustice, that sense of injustice resonates with your own sense of injustice, and that begins to distort your sense of anger. It amps up your sense of anger. So what I often say to people, you know, and I'm working, say, with couples, just, you know, couples in therapy, they'll be so angry. And I said, well, yeah, that's inappropriate, and you need to convey what your need and want is. But what's the part of you that you need to look at, that why this is triggering you? Why? That's the part. If you can work with that part, then you'll be able to communicate. That's the part that, you know, that's where our meditation practice is so important, because when anger comes up in our meditation, in our life, and we can sit with it, like the word that Pema Chodron uses, and moving to the soft spot, you're moving to the place that's underneath the anger. What's the part, what's the fearful part of you? What's the sad part of you that's underneath that anger? Deep work. And that's hard to get to that place, because it makes you vulnerable. But in touching your vulnerability is where your compassion, that's where bodhicitta arises, is out of that soft spot. Because then you can connect, instead of the other person's aggression, you can look below their aggression and see where their soft spot is. The hard work. Really. And that's why it's hard. You have to be very careful when you're using anger as a motivation factor. You know, I don't know, maybe some of you saw that. I heard about it, I didn't see it, but there was a woman at the march in Berkeley when they were a protest, where they were interviewing her, and she said, well, I'm a Trump supporter, and I'm just here, I just want to see, this is the way I heard it anyway, I just want to kind of see what the other side is like. And it was, did anybody see this on TV? Anyway, mm-hmm. And some, did you see it? So yeah. Tell me what I heard is somebody came up and sprayed pepper spray on her. But that's the point. Even in a more extreme example where somebody is really acting out, does that justify that kind of behavior, that kind of aggressive behavior? So from Buddhism, we would say no. And another example was like a Breitbart News was, and somebody came up and actually punched him in the face while he was being interviewed. That kind of thing is not it's not a good message to send out, and that isn't the kind of way you want to use aggression. But it's very easy to move in that direction. I mean, I know when I was a young person back in the 70s, before I was just getting interested in Buddhism, I mean, one year there were like 300 bombings in this country. I really felt outraged, and like violence was the only way to do it. I even had, when I was a lawyer for the National Lawyers Guild, I've mentioned before, I was working with the Black Panthers as one of the lawyers, and somebody came up to me, not from the Panthers, the white person, I want to go do a bombing, and if I get caught, I want you to be my defense attorney. At that point, I just said, you know, I was clarifying my position at that point. How did I want to change things? Through this kind of violence, which is very seductive, actually, you know, because you feel so deeply the injustice. So, and I kept reading the I Ching. I told you that back then. And I still use the I Ching, very ancient book. And I kept coming up with 49, really, in an uncanny number of times, number 49, revolution. There was one phrase in there that turned my life, helped turn my life. At that same time, I was also going to Sufi Roshi, and the phrase said, the heart of a true revolutionary gladdens the hearts of the people. True revolutionary gladdens the hearts of the people. And I decided that was the better path, not the path of violence or anger. Find a way to gladden the hearts of the people. So I started to practice more deeply, and turned towards a more spiritual path. Law was not a good way for me personally, for other people. Thank you, know, goodness for good lawyers. You know, see that right now. There's a tremendous use for law and good lawyers. But for me, I was too susceptible, I think, anger and irritation and seeing one side saw. Towards the side of being a monk, you know, 5 or 6 years to get there, but started that path. So Sometimes we need anger, you know. I see that, you know, and I do work sometimes with people. Sometimes people in an abusive relationship, for example, need to be able to say no, you know, and leave the relationship. Need to be able to say no. Sometimes you need to say no to your teenage kids, you know. No, this is not going to happen anymore, right? Even in school sometimes, right, Bob? So part of the Buddhist teaching, there's a part of Buddhist teaching that says no. You know, we know the ones that we tend to emphasize most are maybe the first way the Buddhist presents teaching, which is to pacify. Take our anger and to calm it, to let it go, to move more into our breath, to still ourselves. Like agitation of mud in a glass, as we sit, it can still. As we don't reify it with our compulsive thinking, still it can pacify. Often that's the one we feel so right to us. And the second is that Buddhist teachings can enrich us, to give us, to work with our sense of inner poverty, to work with a sense of how deficient we feel. So it gives us a sense, you know, of things like the paramitas and metta practice, and just the coming practice of meditation, where we begin to have a different way to view that we're not just our personality, we're not just how many friends we have, we're not just how much wealth we have. Vision of what's possible. A lot of it comes out of economic deprivation. And the third is to magnetize us, to give us a sense that we have something more than just our small self. We have this, our Buddhas. How do we actualize, as the Dhammapada says, how do we give up the small self, the small image of ourselves? So it can magnetize us into a bigger image of what our potentiality is. We take the vow, the Bodhisattva vows at the end of the lecture. So we're moving more into how do we awaken with all people? You know, how do we enter the 10,000 Dharma gates that are available to us? How do we not fall again and again and again into the trap of those things that shut us down? So it magnetizes us. But the fourth way is that Buddha teaches, says no. Says no. It says no to greed, hate, and delusion. Greed in the sense of taking more than you need, you know, which gives rise to the 1%. Nine people hold, 50% of the world's wealth. It says no to greed. It says no to hatred, which is basically racism, which says, I'm right, you're wrong. You know? And it gives rise, and it says no to delusion. Delusion says that I'm the most important thing. It's me. It's my country, which is the most important. Yeah, you are important, but are you really more important than insentient species, people in other countries, are such a tremendous commitment to individualism and material way out of balance in our culture, in Western culture. So it says no to that kind of delusion, to greed, hate, and delusion. So it's important. It gives you the Vinaya. It gives you the 16 Bodhisattva precepts. So when you start, it says, don't harm. Don't use wrong speech. Don't take what is not given. You know, don't slander people. Bodhisattva precepts. It says, don't do those things. Because if you do, you are just going to suffer. So there is a part of Buddhist teaching that definitely says no. But the overriding teaching, as I've been getting from the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu and all the great teachers, is basically it's do no harm. So when anger arises, a sense of injustice arises, we have a sense of gentleness and a sense of awareness about how we monitor and we are with these feelings. And it gives us the practice of meditation so we're not swept away by these feelings. It gives us that sense of a gap where what happens and then our reaction, but there can be a gap between that. Or if we are swept up by it for some period of time, we each have a meditation practice where we can practice so we can see that we're more than our thinking mind. We're more than just our emotions. And we learn, in fact, that aggression is basically somebody's usually maladaptive response to suffering. When people are really aggressive, that's where the anger comes from. And so if we can try to find that place where that suffering comes from. That helps us. We don't just respond to a sense of regret. But that's deep work. And it teaches us to take care. Even when we feel a sense of injustice, we concurrently, as Thich Nhat Hanh does, we walk out in the garden. We go to the beach. We see the waves. We see flowers. We nurture ourselves. We sit in meditation and calm ourselves down. We do metta practice. We do Tonglin practice. We have ways to really take care of. So if we can take care of ourselves, we build a reservoir and a reserve. So when something comes at us that agitates us or insults us, we're not so on edge. We slow down. Because aggression is speed. So notice that when you're moving really fast. Notice the aggressive aspect. Moving too fast, notice how quickly, more quickly you get irritated when something impedes your progress forward. Notice your speed. That's why teachers tend to slow down. You know, try to do a personal retreat. Just slow down. Half of how fast you go. And notice, that'll start again to share things with more gentle. Next time we'll talk a little more about how afraid we are of anger. How we actually are afraid to express it because we can shame ourselves, you know. So how do we actually stay with it in a way where we don't necessarily express it, but we don't suppress it? It doesn't work either. How do we stay with it in our meditation practice? That's not easy work. The hardest time to sit is when you're angry. One of the most productive times. Because you see how you create, amp up your anger. So that's probably enough for today. And we have a few minutes. Let's break into groups of two. Just one other person, maybe you don't know. And just remember, again, speak for 3 minutes. If you want to use your 3 minutes to be silent, fine. Resist the temptation to try to ask questions. Just listen. Be with the other person. See what comes out for them. I'll ring the bell. We'll go on to the second person. And I'll ring it again. And then you can ask your questions. And then we'll come back for at least a minute. Okay? Find one other person. And usually somebody you don't usually get together. You're talking about everything I talked about today. Is there been a useful way that you've used anger? Do you feel it's been useful and have the disadvantages outweighed the advantages? Just anything around that.